This episode was brought to you by Google Cloud, a partner that needs no introduction. What you might not have heard of, though, is that Google offers a Google for Startups cloud program where they give you access to startup experts, technical training, business support, and cover your Google Cloud costs up to $200,000 for 2 years, or even $350,000 if you're an AI startup. Scale your startup faster and smarter with Google Cloud. Head over to goo.gle/Swisspreneur.
Being an entrepreneur makes you a little bit of a sociopathic nature in the end, because you cannot be overly excited about your successes and you cannot be overly depressed about your failures or the what doesn't work. And so your brain ends up being, creating sort of a filter that, it becomes just business, and the hits that you get in your face are less painful and the successes are less enjoyable.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Adrian, a very well welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest today.
Thank you for having me, Sylvan.
You're the founder and CEO at Metaco, an enterprise tech company enabling institutions to securely build their digital asset operations. Before we talk about your impressive story that eventually led to an exit, I want to actually start with your personal background. You have a PhD in finance, and a year before you finished your PhD, you actually started Metaco already. So how related or unrelated were your thesis and your business idea?
That's interesting. I think the main point where there is a relation between the thesis and this entrepreneurial journey is the fact that the thesis gave me a bit of free time to investigate other streams, and one of them being cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and blockchain. At the time of the PhD, I was working actually in the hedge fund industry in parallel as a quant, as an algorithmic trader. And it gave me this sort of enthusiasm for new asset classes and for, cryptocurrencies as I was starting to read articles on, in online blogs like Zero Hedge, for instance. And so the journey of this PhD, which quite often is chaotic, you don't know exactly where you're going, you don't know exactly what you want your specialization to be. Turned out to become more and more about blockchain, because I argued, blockchain is a finance concept, whether we like it or not. It may not be obvious to the finance research today, but it will certainly become a relevant topic. It has also a technological angle and a mathematical angle, and a game theoric angle, which is normally exactly the sort of combo you get in finance, in mathematical finance, which was my stream. And so I started researching, started looking at the crypto markets from a trading point of view, but also from a technology point of view. And this is when my software engineering background came back to life, and I felt again this passion for technology.
Fantastic. And at the same time, you also have this entrepreneurial drive in you to build the company and to really start your own business. Where does that come from? Do you have any role models in your family that inspired you to pursue the entrepreneurial path?
Well, I hope my parents are not listening to this, but it's quite the opposite. They have absolutely no business sense. And so I never got a sort of a proper training or life training to what entrepreneurship would be or should be or would have to be. But one thing they did right is push me and push my sibling, my brother and sister, in experimenting in new fields. Not necessarily from an entrepreneurial point of view, but at least learning new streams in science, in music, in art, in literature, to a point where curiosity became a predominant force. And in a way, becoming an entrepreneur requires a number of things, a sort of enthusiasm for risk, but also requires a natural curiosity for new things, which are not already evident to the market and that you would like to investigate a little bit solitary. And I think from this point of view, indeed, this is how I became an entrepreneur. But I'll be honest with you, I have this anecdote, which I sometimes share, that to become an entrepreneur, you have to be a little bit ignorant about what being an entrepreneur means. Because if you know too much about all of the pain and all of the issues, you tend to not start and delay the start. And you end up, not doing it at all.
Absolutely. I like the two things that you mentioned, natural curiosity. I think that's an amazing guiding light to follow whatever you're passionate about or what you see, but also being maybe a bit naive, you know, what it then means to actually build a company around that, because otherwise, yeah, you would never do that. I love that. So then in 2015, you founded Metaco. First of all, why was 2015 the right time to start the company? Was there any bigger shift happening?
Well, short story, it was not the right time. It was a very, very bad market timing. It was way too early for the market, at least several years. Having this sort of anticipation of the market probably is what served Metaco, because I was and we were very early trying to do it. But, you know, a lot of companies would have died because the market timing was so bad and so early. You know, I was convinced at that time that everything would end up being tokenized very shortly, that the trend was already here, that everything would become a DAO, everything would become, some form of a token, whether we speak about fiat currencies, commodities, fixed income securities, equities, art. I thought everything would be tokenized. And Metaco initially was about supporting these tokenization trends with the proper infrastructure to support the regulated institutions. And nobody wanted this in 2015. So it was a completely, completely wrong entrepreneurial journey at this point. But with persistence, patience, but also the support of investors and shareholders, we were able to survive until the point that market timing became more appropriate.
But I assume when you're in that moment, right, that's not an easy decision to make. You see, of course, the potential, but you also see the market feedback and you realize, shoot, we're way too early to make this happen. What kept you going in that moment and not just say, look, we tried, but it doesn't work, so we just stop and we do something different?
Well, the reality is that we didn't know at the time exactly what we wanted to do. So we actually were very agile, because if something would not work, we would stay in the same sort of macro field of digital assets, cryptocurrencies, and enterprise software. But we could pivot left and right with not so many consequences, because you would not have to lay off employees. You would not have to, change your day to day. You would just have to have to try to create new contacts and try to sell something new to somebody new. And so for the first 3 years, we finance ourselves mostly through consulting, giving consulting mandates around cryptocurrencies, advisory. We built sort of prototypes. We built MVPs, things which are certainly not of a quality where we could commercialize, but enough to create some form of an early reputation about the company locally with certain companies. And this is what led to the first, ability to raise funds and the initial ability to also sell to a few clients. Not perfect, but this lack of, strict strategy allowed us to be agile.
I think that's also a very organic way of starting a company, right? Because you have to survive somehow, and consulting or building smaller things that are not the big product vision are just probably a normal way, an entrepreneurial way of surviving.
It is absolutely correct. I mean, of course, when you are a recurring founder or very experienced or very networked, and you can raise funds very early on simply with your credibility, dare I say, potentially you don't need to have this sort of iterative process and work in your basement to find the first clients for a few years. But when you have everything to prove, you don't have necessarily an obvious experience, it's your second company or your third company, you've already exited, etc. You have to prove yourself, right? And proving yourself is hard work with a lot of failures, more failures than successes. And this is how you eventually have this, this series of chances, if I can say, or a little bit of luck, just enough luck that you're able to, through this effort, get the first investors, get the first advisors, and get one of your ideas or ambitions, which starts converging to something that actually makes sense.
Absolutely. And I want to talk a bit more about the validation of your business idea. Can you take us back there, how you originally went out there to talk to potential customers and then eventually also validated your business idea, whether you were on the right path or not?
Yeah, so this is a story I've already shared a few times, but I'm happy to share it again. Initially, how I got into Metaco was that in 2013, I was I was making my first trades in Bitcoin. It was mostly arbitrage on a very, very inefficient market where there were arbitrage opportunities up to 20%+ across, you know, some of the main two or three exchanges. One of them was called, well, of course, Mt. Gox. Many of you probably still remember about Mt. Gox. But it was Bitcoin 24 in Germany and Bitcoin Central in France. And I was arbitraging these markets with a couple of colleagues. And at some point, you know, we got into issues with the compliance department of our bank, you know, effectively flagging these transactions as being very, very suspicious. And but, you know, we still survived it for a bit longer. But at some point, two of the exchanges got hacked and bankrupt. And I lost most of the deposits. And Mt. Gox was avoided just by a couple of weeks, if I remember correctly. So these assets didn't lose. Now, it led me to believe that the markets would further have to institutionalize in the future. There would be sort of reconcentration of these assets into more professional hands. And at the time, I concluded that this would come hand in hand with the tokenization growth, because, you know, the growth of tokenization market would imply also more need for professional infrastructure in the context of managing such assets. So Metaco was founded with this view that the institutional market would need to be served. It started on the tokenization side. And when I realized with, you know, with a lot of despair that the market was not ready to go at scale into tokenization, at least on the regulated side. And I understood at this point that there would be a first milestone, which would be, well, first the infrastructure to store these kind of assets in an institutional environment, so the custody infrastructure. And this is how Metaco was not born, because it was born with a much more ambiguous idea, but this is how Metaco was formally, you know, going in the direction of its first commercial successes.
Wow, that's an amazing story, because your own problem basically led you to that solution to a certain degree.
Absolutely.
I think that's the best way to get started, because then you have a personal motivation, an intrinsic motivation to get things improved. So when we now talk about what you do today, can you also explain for people who might not be too familiar with the technical jargon around, you know, blockchain, what Metaco exactly does today and what solutions that you offer?
Yeah, sure. So we speak of digital assets or crypto assets or cryptocurrencies. The word crypto means cryptography. It means that these assets are protected by some form of cryptography or mathematical construct. And the main tool that you have behind it is that you have this so-called secret key, which is like a long password. And it protects the access to these digital assets that live on the blockchain, right? These crypto assets protected by cryptography, well, in practice, are protected with this so-called secret key, which is a long password. So the secret key, you can store it in many, many ways. You know, you can have it on your phone, you can have it on a piece of paper, you can just remember it completely by heart. But of course, when you start having assets at scale, millions, billions, or trillions, you probably don't want to, you know, just have it in your mind and hope that you will never forget. Right? Actually, it's a pretty damn long password, so you know it's hard to remember. And even if you could remember it, you know, you become a single point of failure. You know, if you have an accident or, you know, anything, you know, it could mean that you lose forever the access to all of your assets. So, what Metaco does is working and, you know, building the technology that professional institutions can use to do this at scale. In an environment where, you know, risk is obviously paramount. So typically, our main clients are banks that today are providing safe services on the traditional finance side, you know, for, you know, payments, also custody of treasury assets, but payments, current accounts, etc. But we expected many years ago, and we still think that banks will be providing all of these services for digital or crypto assets. But to do so, they need a professional infrastructure to manage the secret keys. They need a professional infrastructure to govern the security around it, to manage the accounting components of it, to connect to the blockchain by and large. And this is the specialty, the expertise of Metaco as a software vendor. Of course, now Metaco goes beyond this, but this is really how it was, how it's been growing the last 5-6 years, and this is how it specialized, and this is the foundation on which it builds everything as it does.
Amazing. Now we also see where the timing comes in, right? Although you were a bit too early in 2015, things rapidly changed then a few years later, and the market picked up fast, I would say, from the outside perspective.
This is absolutely correct. So there are multiple things. You know, if you are on the retail side, if you're a company selling a retail service, a consumer service, generally your success depends on, you know, the adoption of cryptocurrencies. And therefore, the faster the Bitcoin price is going up, you know, the more you get clients in general. And typically, you know, with the price going up again now, there is an expectation that the retail market is going back into, you know, sort of retail services. But if you are an enterprise or a very B2B, even worse, B2Bank provider like Medaco is, there is a lot of inertia. So banks take a long time before they make a decision. But the good thing is once they make a decision, generally it's extremely sticky. But they, of course, still follow some form of a trend. And what is this trend? What is the enterprise adoption of digital assets and tokenization use cases? In particular, are big asset managers looking to, you know, create Bitcoin ETFs, for instance? Or, you know, are my private, you know, high net worth clients as a, you know, wealth bank, as a private bank, are they looking to invest in crypto? And are they calling me every day that they want a solution for this, you know? And eventually, when you get this demand coming from the professional investors and institutional clients, as a bank, you're like, well, you know, something is happening. I need to prepare myself for these trends. Of course, there are other forces, you know, forces more related to cost efficiency, you know, if you think about tokenization or, you know, improving some of the flows. But initially, you know, banks are more thinking, you know, am I able to make more money out of this new use case? Or do I have clients willing to pay for something new? And so exactly as you say, you know, in 2015, there was a lot of, you know, there was a boom on the retail side. You know, the crypto market was very volatile, going up, growing, of course, going down also. But by and large, you know, the market was positively trending over the last decade. But the banking industry was not ready yet for a mass adoption. And, well, I would argue that it's still not ready, right, for a mass adoption. But clearly, something happened in 2018. There was a sort of first boom in the institutional segments, in the banking segment in particular. The second boom was in 2021, 2022. And I wouldn't be surprised that over the next couple of years, we see even more announcements. Well, I can already commit there will be more announcements because we see it from the point of view of Medaco, by many of the large banks globally getting in this field. Not always, or not necessarily with cryptocurrencies, because there is still a general suspicion that these coins are, you know, from a regulatory point of view, a little bit delicate to deal with, which I would disagree, but, you know, banks, of course, have their own processes and beliefs. But very much that blockchain technology, tokenization, etc., is something tremendously important, which may eventually represent, you know, hundreds, if not a thousand of trillion dollar worth of assets on chain.
So if I understood that correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you basically help the banks to get in on the blockchain play and help them make more money by offering more services to their clients in a very fastly, very rapidly growing market.
Correct. Yes.
Fantastic. And you also work with regulated exchanges, but also corporates. Are banks still sort of your number one customer group, the biggest customers group?
I think Medaco has diversified its customer group, but we are still very focused on the higher segment of the market. So it's not only banks, but it's generally large regulated financial institutions. And of course, at the top of the pyramid, you have the large, you know, global tier one banks, which generally are also custodians in some ways in the traditional space. But, you know, we also work with smaller banks, tier two, tier three, with NBFIs, non-banking financial institutions, and more recently with even non-regulated firms. Although I would say this is a new market for us, and this is a market that we consider being relevant, but which has not historically been our priority.
Got it. And just to give people a bit of an understanding of the scope, can you name some of the big banks and big customers that you're working with?
Yes. I mean, some of them are obviously public. I just want to be cautious that I don't associate their names necessarily with cryptocurrencies, because it is important to note that many of these banks are focused very deeply into tokenization, but not necessarily into cryptocurrency use cases today. So what I'm going to say doesn't necessarily imply in any way that these banks are working on the crypto side of business. But, you know, we announced recently HSBC as being a client and partner on tokenization. We announced more recently also BBVA being in collaboration with Medaco. We have relations in Asia with some of the largest banks such as Standard Chartered, with DBS, and with a number of others. We have relations in the United States, North America, in South America. We're also very well present in Africa today. And so I think Metaco, and that's maybe an anecdote which might be interesting in this context, because we were this small Swiss startup in 2018, and we were ambitious with the kind of clients we were targeting, which was, you know, enterprises in general, and we didn't have the resources, both financial and in terms of human resources, we had to focus, we had to set to choose where we would hit. And because we could not target, you know, thousands of, you know, companies, because we didn't have an army of sales, we only had a few people, we decided to target the top of the pyramid, you know, the top of the triangle, and therefore go straight to the with the largest financial institutions, the banks. And we shaped our product and we shaped our go-to-market for that particular segment. The implication also is that we had to immediately go international, because if you target the tier one, you know, big banks of the world, well, there are not so many in Switzerland. So yes, Switzerland is a banking place, but you don't have so many tier one banks here still. So almost from day one, you know, in 2018, we already had captured big international tier one banks in Asia, in Europe, and almost in the US, you know, in the following couple of years.
Amazing. I think that's a very insightful strategy that you just mentioned here. And I also wonder, what does your business model look like? How do you get paid? Is it the classic, hey, we sell you software, you pay us a licensing fee, or how does your business model look like?
So although I don't want to say too much, because part of it is still, you know, confidential in terms of competitive, you know, pressures, etc., I will say that we consider ourselves as being a pure software business. And being a software business, we look to get as much recurring license as possible, because this is how we value our business. This is how we're able to reinvest in innovation. But also because we are close to a financial use case, we tend to have a model which also has a form of upside, can scale with the use by our clients. What are the specific metrics? I'm not going to share today, but the general model is base recurring license with some form of an upside.
Okay, got it. And you work with banks, a heavily regulated space. How did that sort of help you or also hinder you to actually build Metaco to the level and the way it is working today?
Well, first, a consequence of working with banks is that on one side, they are very large companies, for at least the ones we worked with historically, and so very slow and very difficult, a lot of processes. Then you add the fact that they're also one of the most regulated industries of all industries, and you get something which is even a slower animal, even a more processed and painful animal to work with. So this is my biggest learning, and one of the things that, you know, was potentially the most difficult for a young startup was learning on how to deal with companies for which the sales cycle can be between 12 and 36 months. And how to deal with, you know, complex deals, complex sales cycles with RFPs, with extremely competitive environments, with a bank that has hundreds of counterparts to your company, and they expect you to have hundreds of people to deal with their hundreds of people. And of course, you don't have these hundreds of people. And even if you had, you would not have hundreds of people per bank. You would have maybe hundreds of people to share with all of your clients. So this is probably the most difficult thing that we face, the general slow pace of the markets. And a slow pace, which is not just about waiting, but a slow pace, which is about strategically optimizing your positioning and your chances, and potentially risking to miss and to fail the deal with a single mistake because you've lost attention, you know, along this sort of very long journey. Because, you know, when you, as a young startup, you're facing 3, 4, 5 tier one banks in parallel, and all of them expect the big company on the other side, I can tell you this is not trivial. This is a big learning.
At the same time, it can also be a bit of an asset, right? At least that's how I see it, because all the regulations and all these processes to go through that, probably not many startups or just in general, not many companies are willing and able to pull through that process. So that also gave you some sort of a moat to a certain degree.
Yeah, I mean, once you become good at it, you become very differentiated at it. I mean, it's something that's, you don't necessarily understand when you're not in this business. You know, you think, oh, you know, it's just the technology that matters, or it's just this and that, number of people, etc. But when you become specialized in selling to banks, even a company that has more employees, more financing, equivalent product in some ways, may not be the right vendor to these sort of entities because they are not specialized and don't understand the sales process, they don't understand the delivery process, they don't understand the general collaboration and the way to interact. And that's, I think this is indeed, this has been historically a big USP for Medaco to have a deep understanding of this market and how it operates. And, you know, in fact, it's not just the technology, but the entire company of Medaco has been specialized to sell to the sort of higher segments of the market. We have a lot of ex-bankers. We have a lot of enterprise sales, enterprise delivery technicians. Our engineers are specialized. Our product team is specialized. And so in the end, you start speaking the same language and being very deeply aligned with your clients simply because you have specialized for them.
Absolutely. So basically having people who have done that before, who speak the same language, who have the experience, that's one part that allowed you to pull that off. What else helped you to really manage that process is a much smaller Swiss startup dealing with the big top tier banks?
Probably having the right shareholders. And, you know, God knows you never have the right shareholders. You know, I was sometimes criticized as having a cap table, which was a little bit strange for a typical VC-backed company. But at the same time, when you are in this market, you want to have shareholders which are deeply connected with some of these banks and can, at the very least, advise you, but at the best, even help you with connections, with influence, etc. And, you know, Medaco has not been the typical VC-backed company, you know, that goes, you know, starts with around here, then goes with, you know, the big Americans. We've been mostly backed by corporate VC. And there are pros and cons, obviously. You know, the pros is that they're more patient. And this has helped us because sometimes we needed patient investors. And also they may be expert in the field you are, so they may be better advisors in certain ways. But the downside is also that they are sometimes more biased. You know, they're not necessarily in the business for, you know, just a multiple. So they're not here just to make a 10x over the next 24 months. And so they may be here because they want to use you as a client, you know, as a provider and them being your clients. Or they may want to, you know, simply learn about the business because they want to create some expertise on their side. And that creates some form of a conflict of incentive. And if you're not careful with it, depending on how you staff your board of directors also, it can have nefarious consequences. And also, you know, going through the Series B, Series C, Series D, potentially, if you don't somewhat clean up your board, clean up your shareholders, etc., you may end up having, you know, frictions and inertia where you should not in principle if you want to do things right.
Got it. Is there, you know, cleaning up the board, making sure you have the right people in the right seat at the right time? Sounds crucial, sounds simple, but how do you actually do that? You as founder and CEO, how did you shape and manage that process? Because again, this sounds easier on paper than in practice from my perspective.
Yeah, well, I won't claim that I did things perfectly. I certainly did not. I think we had a good board of directors, but it was not perfect. And I even what I would say my seat, you know, because I had a few seats also on the board, even my seats, you know, were they perfect? Probably not. You know, probably I could have fought even more to get, you know, this perfect guy that knows exactly the banking market, etc. In the end, I think that my view as an entrepreneur is that the board is here to support and balance out the entrepreneur, but is not here to formally make sort of the decisions during the growth phase of a startup. Because yes, on paper, from a legal point of view, yes, the board is deciding, is signing, is engaging the company, you know, to protect the, to optimize the value of the shareholders. But in practice, you know, the board is here to trust the entrepreneurs because otherwise, you know, you would know it if the board is better placed than the entrepreneurs to do the work. They would become the CEOs themselves, right? So I think that, the best thing the entrepreneur can do is find a proper modus operandi with the board, where the board is acting as a, not as a friction, not as a, let's say, just a legal thing, but as an advisor when needed, as a counterweight when the CEO needs to have some form of perspective, but generally as a support for the ambition of the CEO, founder, and obviously the rest of the team. I think Medaco managed to do this in a relatively well-working way. It was not perfect, again, but I think it worked. But I know, speaking with a lot of other startups, that it's not always the case.
Yeah, I think that's a big struggle for many startups, especially once they enter the growth stage. Before that, it's not too relevant yet. One thing, you know, when you now talk about the journey that you just shared about Medaco, what is really astonishing to me is that you started the company as a solo founder, something that, you know, when investors, when a traditional VC comes in, they would say, oof, that's something that we usually don't touch. Why was being a solo founder the right setup for you?
Well, I'll reveal something which normally my close relatives know, but not the market doesn't know, is that I'm actually not a solo founder. There was a co-founder, but it didn't work. You know, it didn't work out. We didn't get along, and it broke. It broke up after, I don't remember, maybe 12 months. And so I ended up a solo founder against my will. I ended up a solo founder because I lost my co-founder. However, I certainly agree with you that it was absolutely not an ideal scenario. I almost died multiple times as a business on the way. You know, when the team broke up, the company should have died. Actually, many times in the following 2 years, I wondered, should I have just killed the company? Because it was so painful and so hard to recover from this and to, you know, as you say, convince investors that everything was under control. I wasn't sure I would make it, right? So with respect to investors, it's a very good point you're making. Investors don't like it in general. And I think as a recurring founder, being a solo founder is okay. But as a first-time entrepreneur, you know, 30 years old-ish, this is delicate, right? This is very delicate. And I think I'm lucky here because having gone through many of these pitch competitions, you know, a competition of startups, I met a few people, and in particular, after, maybe 20 of them, I met Francisco Fernandez, the founder of Avaloq, and who exited Avaloq a few years ago. And he kind of got hooked to my presentation, I think, because it was speaking of banks, of cryptocurrencies, innovation, software, etc. And he's the first sort of real milestone in the growth of the company from a capitalistic point of view. He's the one that trusted Meraco and therefore myself to be able to make a difference. He's the one that helped lead the first rounds of financing and brought his credibility on the table and also brought the first leads of the company from a commercial standpoint in banking. So I think that it was far from ideal, very, very far from it. But again, being resilient, continuing pushing, ended up, giving me the chance to meet some people that actually made the difference for the company.
Absolutely. And I mean, not only the investor part, but also you carrying all the weight of the company to a certain degree. Everyone who has a problem comes to you. You don't have a sparring partner, so to speak, that is eye to eye with you, with, being a co-founder and being in this together. What kept you going in this very, very difficult and probably also super intense time?
Very hard. Very, very hard. But I'll put it this way. Had I been truly alone, I would probably not have been able to, keep my head out of the water. But my wife not only has been supportive on a personal level, but I invited her to join Meraco early on in the journey, something like, I think in 2018, actually. I would have to check the dates. And although she's not technical herself, she's always been working in technical environments, and she's been tremendously supportive along the whole journey. And I therefore had someone to speak to, and I didn't get home with my wife complaining that I was never available and that I was too focused on my business and I should be more balanced. So no, because she knew exactly what I was facing at work, and she was not only understanding but also very supportive and generally a good counterpart to sometimes my excessive craze or, my excessive opinions, etc. And so she's certainly one of the pillars that helped me, go through this journey. But, in the end, you also have to be resilient yourself. And it's true that I took a lot of hits. I like to say that being an entrepreneur makes you a little bit of a sociopathic nature in the end, because you cannot be overly excited about your successes. And you cannot be overly depressed about your failures or what doesn't work. And so your brain ends up being, creating sort of a filter it becomes just business, and the hits that you get in your face are less painful and the successes are less enjoyable. And it becomes more day to day, and you accept that you're the ultimate point of concern. Everyone comes to you when there's an issue, and sometimes you have to deal with it yourself, and it's painful and it's hard. But hey, it's part of your job, and you learn to take it.
It sounds like a survival strategy for the startup roller coaster.
It is. It certainly is. But again, what's difficult here is that When entrepreneurs like myself, tell other entrepreneurs, you have to remain resilient, you have to take it, it's part of the journey. It is clearly part of the journey. You have to. But the issue is that you never know if it's actually going to succeed. You actually never know, right? And so it may be that a lot of people are being extremely resilient, are fighting their way through, but never succeed because they don't. It's part of a little bit of chance. It's a little bit of execution. It's a little bit of good market timing, etc. But in the end, nothing is guaranteed. And so in order to succeed, you have to be resilient and you have to insist. But unfortunately, it's not a guarantee. And this is what is so painful because you keep telling yourself, well, I'm being resilient. I'm being committed to it. I'm continuing having growing success. But am I going to end up in a bankruptcy? It could be, right? And therefore, it's still a failure. So it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, it is a prerequisite, but it's not a guarantee for success.
It is it's the sort of if and only if mathematical thing. You have to see which, implication you have. And unfortunately, it's not a bijective relation.
Exactly. Then as you were growing with the company, you then also expanded the leadership team. And I think that's sort of then also when you were really making up for the sort of missing co-founder that got lost along the way. So what were the key roles that you hired for to really set up a strong and a good leadership team at Metaco?
Commercial guy. I come with an engineering background, and I'll be honest with you, I had zero experience in sales and marketing to a point where it was a really systemic risk to the business. I really had zero perspective on how to be growing the company from a perception of point of view, so marketing, and how to grow a sales team to actually go to market and get your product sold and accepted. Of course, I learned on the way, like any entrepreneur, because you're always good at something and bad at something else. Some people are very good on sales and marketing, but have no clue on product and engineering, for instance. So I'm a little bit the opposite. One of the first important hires to complement this was our chief growth officer, he actually had multiple roles, but his name is Seamus Donoghue. Very senior, obviously massive career, both in banking and in sales and as an entrepreneur. And the chance I had is that this hire and this collaboration actually worked to a point that he became almost a de facto co-founder. So he was not, legally speaking or, historically speaking, but the relation became like he was a co-founder. And this is what probably made the company much more robust and resilient for everything that followed, because it creates this robustness of having a strong sort of, first three or four people in the team. Of course, there were a lot of people before, there were people after, but I think this was a defining moment. After this, what came up is that I tried as a company to build a team which would be as senior as possible and ideally much more professional than I would in every field that I would not feel I would be comfortable. So higher in sales, much more senior salespeople than I was. Higher in delivery and eventually a CTO, much more competent than I was. This ability to hire people that were more competent than I was and keep them satisfied in the company, I think truly helped create something where in the end, the exco, the executive committee of the company, was strong enough to be able to sustain the adversity of this environment.
How did you exactly do that? Because, you're 30-something years old. You probably hire people that were much older than you, had big careers. And to do that, first of all, it requires low ego from your side to say, hey, I'm not the best at this. I need someone else. But then also to talk to them, to work together, I imagine that can sometimes also be challenging because you have completely different backgrounds and experiences. How did you make that work and incentivize the people that you all stick together?
I don't know. It's not easy. It's really not easy because you're right. I have people that were almost twice my age. And if you look at the executive committee of Metaco, it is extremely senior. It is not easy, but in a way, the more success you jointly get with these senior people, the more the team as a whole is satisfied, and the more it creates a bond where we're all a team and we forget about the age and we forget about the imbalance. In a way, what saved me is that in what I do well, I do very well, right? I'm very, very good at the things that I do well. But of course, it's a very vertical scope. You know, I don't have a wide horizontal coverage. So at least I think I earned the respect of some people on what I do well. The fact that I would accept that I'm not the best at everything else, which sometimes is hard for a founder, also probably got me some brownie points. I don't know, but it made the relation work pretty well with the rest of the team. But again, not with everyone, you know. We also had people unhappy that left or people that I had to let go for cultural incompatibility or for these profound disagreements on how to address certain things or, you know, because of political conflicts that appeared in the company, which always appear. So it's not been perfect. And I think no company is perfect, but I think indeed we ended up having a company which was probably more stable than many companies of our maturity and taking, you know, as many risks as Medaco was taking at this point in time.
And I think it's also a massive sort of, you know, joining forces when you have the experience, the network, and sort of the career of the people that you hire, but then also the sort of tech-driven software approach. I think that brings a lot of leverage together that allowed it to eventually build a super successful company. Last question on this topic. Where do you actually find the people? Did you reach out to them through your personal network? Did you work with a headhunter? How did you find the people for your leadership team?
For the leadership, it's been through personal network mostly, and then through extended personal network. So effectively the network of the network. In particular, some of the senior people that joined the company then brought their own senior people along. And because, you know, when you know that culturally you get along with, you know, these people, then you know that the culture generally also expands one step beyond that. You know, if they have a good feeling with the person, it's probably something good still. We've worked with recruiters for some positions, but not for the top management. It's hard to find good recruiters, I'll be honest. You know, most of them, dump some LinkedIn profiles that they've, you know, mass search, and it's for you to do the job. But we indeed found some excellent recruiters that were able to help us staff some of the mid-management positions that truly made the difference in every part of the company. But for the exco, for the executive committee, no, it was mostly through personal contacts or, you know, indirect relations.
Got it. And we still have sort of an elephant in the room that we haven't talked about yet, about the year 2023. It brought good news to Medaco. There was an exit of $250 million to Ripple. And I just jumped right into the first question about the exit story. An exit, you had investors on board. Was an exit always your end goal with Medaco from the beginning?
You know, I think I was no longer really thinking in depth about it in the sense that, of course, you want to exit at some point because you're taking so much risk that you, at some point, you have to remove this risk and convert it to something which you can exchange, right? Whether it's dollar or something else. Because you cannot be an entrepreneur valued in principle to something, but still risking your life every 2 years when you're raising funds, right? So, of course, you're thinking about it, but I was not really thinking of it as something short term. We had acquisition opportunities in the past already, several ones, but the ambition was really to go into a Series B. Actually, we had a Series B on the table with a term sheet with almost 50 million committed to the company at very good terms with excellent investors, etc. So the opportunity came up and it was really assessed against other opportunities, and it ended up being a good opportunity in many ways. The collaboration made sense, the business opportunities made sense, etc. And so we took it. But did I have the acquisition ambition in mind at this special point in time? No, not necessarily.
It was sort of the opportunity that presented itself at the right time.
Well, you know, the fact is when you're speaking with companies on the market about investments, quite often the discussion goes in, you know, what are the options on the table? Actually, some investors may be saying, well, yeah, we're interested to invest, but, you know, we might be interested to invest even more or potentially have a majority stake. And you naturally get in these discussions, any maturity in the company. It happens sometimes even in the Series A or even earlier. You have something strategic to an investor and they say, well, you know, it's relatively cheap on the market. Why not take it already and take a great team, only have five people, and we work with it together. So I knew that these discussions would happen. These discussions actually happened more generally than what is public information today. But again, I was not searching for it. It happens naturally.
Absolutely. And we heard at the beginning, you know, you as a solo founder managing the business, that was already a lot of stress and really difficult times. Now let's add the size, the scope of the business that Metaco grew to. But now you also had the whole sort of M&A process to go through. It feels like it just threw you a bit back into the stress and doing everything at the same time. How did you manage and juggle the M&A process while not neglecting the operational side of the business?
Yeah, I mean, it's a disaster. It's a disaster. And the reality is that there is an additional stream that you did not mention, which is that I was raising a Series B at the same time in parallel. This in itself is already a complete mess, right? It's been really, really difficult. The last 12 months, I mean, since summer last year, doing business as usual, continuing closing deals while you do Series B, while you discuss acquisition opportunities, it is very, very intense. The first thing is, well, being resilient and having support around you. And I had a lot of support by relatives and by my colleagues and by the company generally, the ones that could be involved, because of course you can't involve everyone in these discussions. And also had amazing support by, at some points by our investment bankers, Brian Garnier, the French company, I mean, the French guys, and by our personal finance advisor. I don't know if he would like me to name him, but I will still do it. Alex Banz, an amazing guy who helped me personally remove a lot of weight from my shoulders and make sure that we would still progress even when I had 0 minutes to to work on progress.
Amazing. Again, the support ecosystem that you build around yourself is crucial to make it to the end of such a process. So,
yeah, it is 100%.
You built Metaco for the past 8 years, and you know, when you sort of hand over your baby to a new owner, so to speak, that can also be difficult for a founder. How did you experience this? Was it easy for you to let go to a certain degree, or was it also difficult on an emotional level?
So I think the most difficult part was before acquisition, having to explicitly decide between two tracks, and one of them being giving away your baby, as you say. No, it's very, very hard to make this decision. And here again, you know, I generally am a person that takes decisions even when they're hard. This one was a very, very hard one where I had to ask for opinions around, should I really let the baby go because it's so difficult. But once the decision was made and it started to be executed, I think this is one of the reasons why I was so excited by this collaboration with Ripple, is that it was the goal of Ripple was not to, just take a few good people of the company, take some pieces of the product and kill everything else. It was actually to leverage as much as possible of what the company had become. Therefore to continue at least the current strategy of the company, but augment it with many new synergies and opportunities. And in this context, I did not really feel like I was losing the company once the acquisition had been concluded. I felt that the context was different. You know, the means were potentially at a different scale. Everything was much larger, with the pros and the cons, because again, it's not, being larger doesn't always mean it's easier. You know, there are new challenges that appear on the way. Even today, I still feel that the baby is growing. I still have some sort of ownership and influence on it that is enough for me to be satisfied and seeing it's continuing being a success.
Amazing. And I wonder, how did you celebrate this important milestone? Did you treat yourself to something? Did you throw a big party? What was the celebration like for you?
Well, it's not very glamorous, but I did not celebrate. There was
nothing.
No celebration.
Back to work.
No. I was working the next day normal as an employee. So no, there was no celebration.
Got it. And please also share a bit about the future plan. So what does this now mean for Metaco? What is Ripple doing with Metaco? What are your plans for the future?
So, you know, as you might know about Ripple and what I've described about Metaco, you know, it's two very complementary businesses. Of course, both are software businesses with, you know, a focus on financial markets, you know, more extensively with Ripple also on the corporate markets, but very much aligned on the sort of market that we're addressing. But Metaco is focused on the deep infrastructure layers of custody and few related things, whereas Ripple is focused on the layers that we call the value-added layers, you know, payments, tokenization, etc., which very naturally complement what Metaco is doing. So the opportunity is really to combine these layers and have a verticalized offering which goes way beyond what Metaco was ever able to achieve, and which complements downstream what Ripple has had historically with the layers that Metaco is bringing.
Fantastic. And Adrian, to wrap up the conversation today, we also have a few rapid fire questions for you. I give you a short question of different options to choose from, and you have to answer in one sentence. You ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Have you ever seriously thought about giving up on Metaco?
Oh, yes. Many times, but many times in the early days. Once I got committed into it, I had employees and I had colleagues I respected. I felt it was my duty to bring it to an end, a good end.
I love that. What does money mean to you?
Freedom. Money for me is what you need if you want to be less dependent on the system. So for me, it's not necessarily Lamborghinis and Ferraris, but it's more about making sure that, for instance, if I want to create another company, I could do it without having to beg for some financial support.
Absolutely. And what's your favorite memory of the Metaco journey?
You know, I told you that I become a bit of a sociopathic nature to be able to survive this journey. I have a number of them, but I would say probably some of the key hires that we made in the company in the early days, in particular, as I said, the first commercial employee or partner, which we became the Rosco founder. It's probably one of the happiest moments that it worked out because it made such a big difference and created also a friendship, I believe.
Amazing. Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Bitcoin, because of its you know, political nature, where that I think I'm aligned with. Ethereum, obviously, in terms of its potential use cases. I think it's hard now to have one or the other. But if I had to choose one, because I'm kind of political in, you know, in mind of freedom oriented, etc., I think Bitcoin represents this ideology closely.
Got it. Switzerland or Spain?
Oh, depends for what. For living, Spain. actually just Spain.
Spain. Just Spain. Fair point. And the last one for you today, investor or founder?
Founder. I don't think I would be a good investor. It's very hard to judge a company, I think, and there is a lot of stress in being an investor observing the decisions of the founders, which you might not always agree with, but sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. So I prefer having the ownership of success and failure, and I must say that I trust myself more than I trust somebody else. So entrepreneur.
Fantastic. Adrian, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun talking to you today. All the best and lots of success for the future. We're really excitedly following your journey to see what's next for you.
Thank you, Sylvain. It's been great.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.